From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor. Today we speak with Dr. Michael Chin, who is the new OBGYN practicing at Intermountain Park City Hospital, and will also serve as the medical director for the OBGYN department.
And then while we had our conversation with Dr. Michael Roizen, the chief wellness officer at the Cleveland Clinic, we had that scheduled for today. We're going to bump that to next week. He will be talking to us about cracking the longevity code for a younger tomorrow, his new book. So we'll look forward to that. Tune in next week to hear that. Instead, we will rebroadcast a conversation that I had earlier. One of my favorite people, Rabbi Steve Leder, who will teach us how to write an ethical will. It's a letter to our loved ones that will help them understand what we have learned about how to live a meaningful life. It's a really great conversation and a great exercise for all of us to do. So we will be rebroadcasting that in the second half of the show today. This is The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
This morning, we welcome to the studio Dr. Michael Chin. He's a new OBGYN at Intermountain Park City Hospital. He's also the new medical director of the OBGYN department. Dr. Chin has been in practice for 25 years and spent the last 17 years practicing in St. Louis, where he was also the chair of the OBGYN department and served in many leadership roles. He has been nationally rated in the top 10 percentile for excellence in patient satisfaction for the last 10 consecutive years. That is something to boast about. Dr. Michael Chin, welcome to The Mountain Life. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me this morning, Leslie and David.
And let's talk a little bit about your background and what brought you to deciding to become an OBGYN.
Well, practicing obstetrics is definitely a unique profession. And when I was choosing my medical career, going through the process of medical school and residency, there's no other facet of practicing medicine that is like obstetrics in terms of guiding patients through their pregnancies and, of course, delivering those beautiful babies. It's a truly unique experience.
Mm. Well, you know, when David was born here in Park City just a few years ago, there was no hospital here. And when I had my children here, I nearly had my child on I-80 going to Salt Lake. And in fact, I have a friend who did have her child on I-80 going to Salt Lake. And it's a different world now with Park City Hospital. Talk a little bit about, you know, what birthing looks like. Are there birthing suites or what does it look like at Park City Hospital?
Oh, absolutely. Coming from St. Louis and transitioning here, Park City has just an amazing, amazing hospital. The facilities there, first and foremost, are top rate for patient care. So the support system for patients and their newborns is outstanding. The nurses and anesthesia staff are outstanding. I always tell my patients the most important people involved in a birthing process, not counting the patient, is your anesthesia doctor and your nurse. And so at Park City Hospital, we have just outstanding facilities to provide care for our patients here in the community.
Growing up, my neighbor was a OBGYN, and he was serving in Salt Lake in, you know, early 1900s. And he kept a relationship with a lot of his patients throughout the years. And so being in a community like St. Louis for 17 years, is it fun to watch the patients that you delivered and watch them grow up? And do you have that kind of relationship with some of your patients as they go along?
Oh, absolutely, David. You know, taking care of women's health, you have a very unique opportunity to follow a lady through her lifespan. I've had patients when I was in St. Louis where I started taking care of them as young ladies and adolescents, and then watched them literally grow up, get married, have children, and go on through the time of menopause, et cetera. So that might be dating me a little bit. My age is probably getting on record now, but but it is a true privilege to be able to be with a patient through that time frame.
I can only imagine. And so as you are there to witness arguably the most iconic, you know, special moment in someone's lifetime is bringing a child into this world. What is some of the most rewarding parts about your job that you do day to day?
The most rewarding part is really walking that journey of pregnancy with patients, being there, answering the questions that they might come up with that just helps to reassure them that things are going well, providing information to them to help them empower them to make those good medical decisions for themselves. You know, I think practicing medicine, really one of the keys is it's partly being a teacher. It's helping patients understand what's happening, what can happen, and how to make those good choices for themselves so that they can get through and have healthy outcomes.
Yeah, that sounds great. And I'm wondering, Dr. Chen, what do you say to those women? And I know that they're out there who say, I just can't have a male OBGYN.
Yeah, we see that a lot still. And I think the key there is I respect that. That's the first starting point. I think of a story sometimes. I've seen some younger patients, and that's sometimes particularly common in that care setting. And the way I approach it is I walk in and we just try to establish some trust. We talk a little bit about maybe where they are in their lives to try to get the conversation rolling. And I feel like once we establish that trust, even for those younger patients or those apprehensive patients, as it relates to having a male provider, then we're heading off in the right direction. And that's worked great for my career thus far.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And then you were also expanding the OBGYN department at Intermountain Park City Hospital with a nurse practitioner. Jenny Hewlett?
Yes, Jenny Hewlett's going to be joining us at the Park City Specialty Clinic in November. She's going to be an outstanding addition to our team there. High energy, great knowledge, and ready to serve those residents of Park City. So we're very excited to have her join us. And with Jenny and I joining the Park City Specialty Clinic, along with all the other providers that are there, I think we're going to be well suited to take care of the residents in Park City.
I had a couple friends during the COVID pandemic time have a child right in the middle of lockdown. And I was curious about how that affected not only your practice and your patients and their mental stability during that time, and how has it changed things for the future?
Yeah, David, COVID really definitely changed so many different things in the way we practice medicine and provided care. The real changes there were that, unfortunately, the birthing process, which often I look at as a family kind of event. So oftentimes we would have mothers, mother-in-laws maybe there at the hospital, et cetera. But with COVID and the restrictive policies in relation to keeping everybody safe and the hospital safe, that became more of an isolated process. And I think that was hard on some patients. Our goal as providers there was to still try to make sure, of course, patients had good outcomes, safe outcomes, and that they still felt like they had that support. But it was definitely a challenging time for everybody in medicine.
I can only imagine the new age of natural has come in, and a lot of people are, you know, everyone's an expert now with WebMD and all these things. I'm sure that's the most frustrating part of your job, but how has, you know, the medical practice changed with your practice as far as individuals coming in with their own ideas and natural ways of doing things versus the typical science and medical behind it?
Yeah, David, so the way I like to approach that is I feel like the more empowered my patients are, the better. I love it. I think the key there is, and the challenge for providers is trying to decipher some of the maybe inaccuracies in social media that we see. And I always like to try to, you know, approach that in a tactful manner, saying, hey, you know, this is great that you are reading about this. But I want to make sure that we're clear that some of the science behind what we're trying to do to help you take care of your health and wellness, that we have that evidence-based. Evidence-based meaning that, hey, there's research that shows this or this. And sometimes if patients are kind of hard to kind of come around and understand that point of view, I will often then reference them to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists website. ACOG.org is a fantastic website. Very patient-friendly, information presented in a very readable fashion that can help them say, hey, this is an authority on the matter, and let's kind of keep our vision on what's going to be best for you. And that's how we approach it.
I would imagine that there's some very sensitive steps that you have to take when you're sort of coaching a patient that way. There are a lot of people, and I think we even see sitcoms about it, where they come in and they have this whole birthing plan in mind, and boy, it's going to go this way. And yet, you know, best laid plans can often go up if you know, a woman is not proceeding along and her body and the baby is in some sort of distress. So that all goes out the window. But I'm wondering, in terms of, you know, like David suggested, that we are taking our labor and delivery as women and as men as well, the father, into more into our own hands in terms of what we choose. And I think when my mom had children, it was what everything that the doctor chose. And now we have a lot more choice. And how do you see, what does the evidence show for, you know, when a woman really has all of those choices, and, you know, is there some level of empowerment that creates a better sort of birthing process?
Absolutely. I think when we talk about patients being empowered, I think the other part of that is that when patients are empowered, they're engaged. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in my career, the more a patient is engaged, the better the outcomes typically are. And if a patient's engaged and I'm engaged with them and they're engaged with me, then that helps us make sure that we have that communication. And the key to providing great care is being able to communicate with patients. They communicate to me their anxieties, their fears, their needs. And that allows me then to tailor my care, as long as it's safe for the patient, and in this case, the baby on its way. As long as it's safe, then we can then execute those plans and provide that environment where patients are both empowered and engaged.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how many women these days, percentage-wise, you know, have a doula or a birth coach? How many use nurse midwives and things like that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question there. So it kind of depends on the community, I think, there, Leslie. If I want to draw back to my St. Louis experience, many patients would often ask me, Dr. Chen, I'd like to go and have natural childbirth. What percentage of women have natural childbirth? And I would often tell them, it's probably about 10%, plus or minus. Now, as I get more acclimated here in Park City, in general, what I have found that there are different levels of health here than potentially in other parts of the country. And I would suspect it's possible that natural childbirth rates here might be slightly higher. It also might hinge a little bit on ethnicity. Certain cultures value natural childbirth more than others. And so that's something that we would take into account as well. But I would say in general, if you look nationwide, again, depending on each individual, smaller communities might differ, what have you, maybe rural communities a little different, but probably between 10 and 20%. Leslie, I always tell patients, if they choose the natural childbirth route, I always tell them, I think that's great. I want to let them feel that they're empowered to do so. Mm-hmm. I want to let them know that we're on their side. I want to let them know that we have nurses that are going to be there for them, and their physician's going to be there for them. With that being said, I always tell them the caveat also that not always what a person envisions a natural childbirth turns out to be what they thought it would be. And that it's okay to change gears if you decide it's not for you halfway through. So I think sometimes moms kind of feel like, well, I decided on this and now I've got to go that way, don't I, Dr. Chen? No, we can change course. It's okay.
Good.
Have you noticed with the Park City community being a very active, healthy community, are there different things that you're seeing with your patients as far as overall health or preventative type measures that they need to take as opposed to a more, like a bigger community like St. Louis where maybe health isn't the forefront?
Yeah, absolutely. Here, I think there's a population that is clearly invested in their health, and it lends itself to that, right? Park City is beautiful. You're outdoors. There are activities both in all the different seasons. And I think, again, across the country, the demography in different communities, it's just different. It's not one community being better than the other. I think it's just a mindset. And we're lucky here in Park City that mindset is kind of focused on healthy living, being outdoors, staying active, eating right, you know, all the things that we encourage patients to do.
Yes, we're very lucky and fortunate to be in this community and have that be a forefront for our lifestyle. What are some of the preventive measures you would recommend to your patients and women coming in and what kind of tests and things they can do up front just to make sure that their yearly checkup is up to date?
Yeah, probably the first thing, David, is that we encourage patients to be mindful about seeing their doctors regularly. We talked about COVID a bit earlier, and COVID kind of threw a lot of people off because you didn't have access. They said, well, the office is closed. We're not seeing patients. People started to miss their annual screening tests for women mammography above the age of 40, one of the real central keys. We would often see patients be tardy, so to speak, on their screening tests. So the first thing, David, would just be staying engaged, being mindful about seeing your physician regularly. And others are things that we encourage in all age groups, eating healthy, staying active, and being mindful of different symptoms that may feel different so that you can bring that to the attention of your physician.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Dr. Michael Chen. He is the new medical director for obstetrics and gynecology at Intermountain Park City Hospital, joining us for his first KPCW interview. And we're happy to have him in the studio with us. And I wanted to ask you, Dr. Chen, about, you know, moving on from having babies, and it's funny how it's so easy to focus in on that conversation because it's such an exciting and happy one. But there are lots of other things that go on with women. And I wanted to ask you about, you know, David brought up a moment ago about deferred maintenance, I guess you might call it, especially during the pandemic, and the need to come in. And this is my question. Is it yearly for a pap smear? Is it every 3 years? How can you assess the risk, if someone's at risk or not, all of that?
Yeah, absolutely, Leslie. So the practice of gynecology, or taking care of the female patient outside of pregnancy, has evolved quite a bit in the last probably 5 to 10 years or so. Back in the old days, it would not be unusual for mothers to bring their young daughters into the doctor's office as soon as they may have begun having their menstruation. Now these days, that's not necessarily the case. And what I try to emphasize with patients first and foremost is we do a lot of different things in the office visit other than simply the pap smear. I could certainly understand how patients might simply equate a visit with their gynecology doctor with having a pap smear, because historically that's really that was the central part. But now these days we focus on so many different other things, health and well-being, and of course depending on their age group, maybe they're going through the early phases of menopause. And if it's an adolescent, maybe empowering them by teaching them about what's out there for family planning options. So there's so many different things that go on. Bottom line is when I counsel my patients, an annual visit certainly is still not out of the realm of reality. If you're talking about pap smears, Leslie, for low-risk individuals, then they only need a pap smear about once every third year. For ladies who may have had abnormal pap smears in the past, surveillance might need to be done more frequently. But I think the key here is knowing that going to the doctor means more than just simply getting a pap smear now these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wondering about I think because it's been a while since I've been in the family planning stage, and I am maybe just kind of on the fringes of knowing what family planning entails these days, and if, you know, what are the new forms of birth control? And I know you're probably going to say it really, you know, it depends on the patient, what is best for them, and that's what you help. But what are some new things that David and I might not know about when it comes to birth control?
Leslie, the arena of family planning has really also evolved tremendously probably over the last 5 years. I think the really important take-home message now is there are many, many good, effective, safe choices for our patients. And we can find usually something that fits. When I counsel patients about family planning, we sit, we talk about the different choices, and we really emphasize that, hey, let's find something that fits their needs, their health needs, obviously, as well, and their quote-unquote lifestyle. Because certain things that require daily use or what have you might not fit a certain lifestyle, might be more difficult to use. But there are indeed many different things out there now these days, Leslie, and there's a plethora of things that can provide healthy, safe options for patients.
What about the vaccine as far as coming into for a young child when mothers decide to vaccinate their young babies? Are we seeing any kind of concerns or risks for a certain age of children getting vaccinated, and what are the conversations you're having with the young, you know, mothers about this?
And David, with that being said, there are a number of different vaccines. Is there a vaccine that you had particularly in mind?
No.
Okay. So when newborns are delivered, there's a certain set of vaccines that are quote-unquote standard. These are all scientifically proven, evidence-based vaccinations that have been clearly shown to improve neonatal health. And so the way we approach it is, first, always empowerment. Patients are allowed to decide to forego vaccination for their newborn if they choose to. But we do our best to educate patients that these are things designed to provide healthy outcomes for our newborns and encourage them to participate in those vaccine programs.
Just wondering, you know, based on this question, you must work very closely with the pediatric department there at the hospital. And you know, how does that work? You know, because while you might counsel someone on vaccinations, really it's the pediatrician who is going to be administering the vaccine, or maybe, you know, talking even more. How does the OBGYN department and the pediatric department work together? And are you, you know, physically in the same space at the hospital?
Yes, we always historically have been very closely intertwined. Oftentimes, obstetricians will say that pediatricians and neonatologists are our best friends, because when that baby comes out and maybe needs a little extra special care, those are the doctors that provide that care and help that baby transition to life outside the womb. So we work very closely. We have a wonderful, wonderful team at Park City Hospital in terms of newborn care. And when a patient might come up with a question about whether or not they want to participate in vaccinating the newborn, both the pediatrician and obstetrician try to get involved. But yes, Leslie, the pediatrician would probably take the lead in terms of some of that counseling. But because the obstetrician has that long ongoing relationship with the patient, sometimes I'll step in and say, hey, you know, the pediatrician, these are all accurate things. Give it some thought, and we're here to help you. So let us know how we can do that.
Okay, let's fast forward to menopause, because why not? There are bioidentical hormones, and gosh, I don't even have the vocabulary for all of it. But what are we learning now about helping women through that stage of life to keep the most normal feel, you know, lifestyle that they have experienced, you know, pre-menopause?
Taking care of women in the menopause has also changed a bit in the last several years. To give some historical background, back in the old days, it would not be uncommon that doctors would prescribe hormone therapy starting at a certain age, let's just say 45, when certain ladies might start to feel, maybe not themselves, they're having certain symptoms or what have you. And it wouldn't be uncommon that we would just give that to them and say, here you go, and we'll take this for the rest of the days to come. Many years ago, there were some studies done that clearly showed that pharmacologic use of hormones had certain risks. And that shook up the landscape quite a bit, because it used to be pretty routine just to use hormones and say, hey, I feel great, doc, so let's just stay on this. But as the risks became apparent to those medicines, we had to take a step back. We had to kind of say, is this the right thing? Because are we doing harm? Remember, as physicians, we're always taught and taken an oath not to do harm first. That's mm-hmm. our mantra. So that really changed things in menopause. Now these days, the way we help women is we really sit down, try to establish what symptoms they're having, and then outline what options there are for them. Some of that might be pharmacologic therapy, which means going to the pharmacy and picking up some medicine. Some of it might be something more natural based. But the key is having a conversation with your doctor about how you're feeling, and then assessing how those symptoms are affecting your quality of life, and then deciding, okay, do I need to do anything about this? Now my doctor's told me these are the things I can do.
Well, Dr. Michael Chen, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. We're so glad that you're here in the community. And before we let you go, can you just give us an overview of who is in your department, or how many OBGYN are there? You know, you've got now this certified nurse midwife and new nurse practitioner, Jenny Hewlett, who will be starting in November. Is that correct?
That's correct, Leslie. Yeah. Okay. We have a great department. We have Dr. Jeremy Clark, who's been in the community for an upwards, I think, of 8 years now. Dr. Catherine Sarnowski and Dr. Emily Baltes, who also recently joined. We've got a full team there.
Yeah.
And we are certainly ready to take the reins and serve those residents and surrounding communities of Park City. So we're ready to go.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us this morning. It's been a pleasure getting to know you.
Thank you so much for having me, Leslie.
Yep.
David, thank you.
And stay with us. We will be back after these words from our underwriters. You're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
Well, we are going to look forward to bumping our interview with Dr. Michael Roizen until next week. It's been a long time coming. He's the director of the Cleveland Clinic, and he has this wonderful new book on longevity, cracking that code to longevity. In the meantime, we are going to rebroadcast an interview that I had several months ago with Rabbi Steve Leder, who's really one of the most fascinating people. This is, he has written a couple bestsellers, The Beauty of What Remains, and now this new book about how to write an ethical will. It's a letter to our loved ones. It's a new book called For You When I Am Gone. Please enjoy. My guest, Steve Leder, has been a rabbi for 35 years. In that time, he has presided over 1,000 funerals, written more than 1,000 eulogies, and sat with over 1,000 families in the aftermath of losing loved ones. In his new book, For You When I Am Gone, 12 Essential Questions to Tell a Life Story, he talks about how we often focus on the material things we leave behind when we die, when what we really should consider is the legacy we leave behind. We write a will to divvy up who gets what, but rather than just stuff, we should be leaving something that speaks to who we wanted to be, who we were, and what we want for our loved ones in their lives. Rabbi Steve Leder, welcome back to The Mountain Life. Great to have you.
Thank you so much, Lynn. I appreciate being with you. I always love talking to you.
Well, thank you. Let's start with this. I think that most people would say, wow, what a good idea, but I just don't have a story. You know, and I think many of the people whose passing you have been present at pass without leaving that legacy or that book. You know, there are photos left behind. And like you say, the divvying up of things, assets and things like that. Talk to us about why we need to do this.
All of us fall prey to some degree, to a really heartbreaking mistake in our lives, which is that we get seduced into believing that the material, physical stuff can somehow express our feelings for the people we love and can somehow tell our story and enable them to be guided by us when we're gone. But I often say to people, believing that the material can express the emotional is like giving people a picture of food. It's not going to nourish or sustain them. It's not what people will want or need from us when we're gone. What they want and need is not our stuff. In fact, most people don't want our stuff. What they want and need is something much more powerful and concrete, which are our words. They need our story. They need our life lessons. And not only do they need it when we're gone, if we are able to really ask and answer some probing questions with real honesty and vulnerability while we are alive, the answers to those questions not only tell our life story, but they also help us hold that life story up to the light, almost like an X-ray, and ask ourselves, am I actually living this truth that I say I believe in, that I say I want my legacy to my loved ones to be? Is my life kabuki, or am I living my truth? And so this book is a powerful exercise for us now and for our loved ones when we're gone. It's part of this great reevaluation that I think is going on in America post-pandemic. A lot of us are asking ourselves now, do I really want to live this way? Is this really what matters? Is this really who matters? And if not, I'm going to change. I'm going to make a change. I'm going to be better aligned with what I believe is a meaningful life. And this book is a way to get to that level of essentialism. These questions have been refined over 35 years to help me get to the truth of a person's life, Lynn, not the facts. You know, an obituary and a eulogy are not the same thing. An obituary tells you the facts of a person's life, which really don't tell you very much at all. A eulogy is meant to tell the truth of a person's life. And why wait until you're dead to think through the truths of your life and ask yourself, am I living these truths? And am I bequeathing these truths to the people I care about?
So this book is as much for the living, helping us get to a path of a life better lived, as it is for really those, from your title, For You When I Am Gone. It's for us now. So it shouldn't be only the elderly that are going through this exercise. It should be all of us.
Far from the elderly alone. I have found this book to be very powerful for two different groups of people. One, for all of us, and this has nothing to do with our age, for every one of us who has come to this powerful realization in a very real way that we are going to die. And therefore, how are we going to live? What are we going to do with this gift of life itself? The other group is the generation of my own children. I have a 33-year-old son and a 30-year-old daughter who are trying to find their way in a very complicated world and who are asking themselves, how do I really want to live? What is my path? What will bring meaning? What will bring love and purpose into my life? You know, last week, a journalist asked me one of those journalist questions, which is, you know, can sum the message of your book up in two words? You know, one of those sort of trick, kitschy questions. But it came to me immediately. And those two words are, don't wait. Don't wait to ask these questions of yourself and answer them. And don't wait to share those answers with the people you love. Don't wait. It's never too soon to examine your life. And it's never too late to examine your life. And you're right. This book is about the future. You know, I often say to people in, I've given up all hope of a better past, right? I think that's a very healthy perspective on life. I've given up all hope of a better past. But we are not, and therefore, we are not prisoners of the past. We're not shackled to yesterday's ways. By examining our past, we can change our future. And that's really what the book is about.
If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with Rabbi Steve Leder, his new book, For You When I Am Gone. So you go through 12 questions in your book to help us get at these answers. I just went on a family trip with our two sons, and they're in their 20s. And I wanted to start having these kinds of conversations, but I didn't have the questions. I wish I had had your book then. And what a great family conversation to have. So let's go through some of these questions. And it's interesting you start off with chapter one is, what do you regret? I just had a conversation with Daniel Pink, and his book is all about the power of
regret.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And so why is it important to summon up and to revisit what we regret?
And why first, right? Exactly. The first question. It's the first question because to answer it honestly, we have to crack ourselves open. We have to respond with real vulnerability and humility. And that puts us in the proper frame of mind, not only to address that question, but all the questions to follow. Let's get real right away. So that's why it's the first question. Now, what did I learn from answering that question myself and asking it of the other, 35, 40 people who contributed to this book? What I learned was that what most people regret most is not something they did. Because we tend to find a way to forgive ourselves and be forgiven over time. Mm-hmm. For the things we did that are regrettable. What most people regret most is something they didn't do. The opportunity they didn't grasp, the words they didn't say, that's the deepest level of regret. And again, it goes back to this idea, don't wait. And if you can be honest about your regret, the missed opportunity, it changes your future. And it also changes the future of your loved ones, if they can remember the truth of that regret and not repeat it themselves. So the question is the first one because it requires real humility and vulnerability, but also because it makes it very clear that this is a book about the future as much as it is about our past.
Mm-hmm. This second chapter is a question about leading with our hearts. And I imagine that without that first chapter, what do you regret? I mean, that's helping us get to our truth, right? And then looking at when we led with our heart. And I wonder how many people and all the people you talk to lament that they never have actually led with their heart, or if they did, they don't know when it was.
I found that it was an easy question for most people to answer.
Oh.
Why? Because it's rare. We tend to remember the exceptional and the rare in our lives. Most people rarely lead with their heart, but when they do, it's life-changing. So let's ask you. Let's pretend you're a contributor. Okay, Lynn? When was a time that you led with your heart rather than your rational mind? When was it? What was the decision? Take us there, and then I'll have a follow-up question for you.
Well, it's funny because the way I posed my question, I think it was very self-reflective that I'm not quite sure. But what comes up for me was when we had a surprise pregnancy, and I just knew with all of my heart that this was the right decision and went into it with a big open heart. And that's
And what's been the result of that decision?
Oh, an awesome kid who I love with, every fiber of my being. So, yeah. And I wish I had 20 more just like him.
Yes. You know, I'll tell you something. I had a conversation a couple of days ago about the book with Katie Couric. She said the same thing. She said, both of my kids were unplanned
And my God, what a gift, what a blessing. So what have we learned? We've learned that part of our legacy to our loved ones, part of our lesson to them from our lives is that if you privilege your heart, the most beautiful, miraculous things in your life will occur. Mm. And that doesn't mean being irresponsible or foolish. It's leading with your heart. It's not leading with your heart to the exception of your rational mind. It's privileging your heart. It's leading with your heart. And when we do that, those tend to be the most powerful and beautiful decisions of our lives. And they're very often about love. Mine was that my wife and I, we got engaged on our second date. We were 24 years old, and I just looked at her and I said, I don't know if I should say this or not, but I think you're it. And Betsy looked at me and she said, well, I feel the same way. And then I said, as only a 24-year-old could, so are we engaged? And she said, I guess so. And that was it. 37 years later, you know, that was it. And it's been a glorious ride. Now, had I been using my brain and not my heart, I don't know. I might have married an accountant or something and had a boring life. I don't know.
Oh,
so that's why it's such a powerful and instructive question. It leads to love.
Mm. To all the accountants out there who are listening, I know that you're arguing accountants can have a really exciting life as well.
It wouldn't have worked well for me.
For you.
That way. My wife is a painter, and it's led me down a very interesting path.
Well, yeah, it's probably helped as a catalyst for your creativity and all these books that you are writing. And
I paint with words and she paints with paint.
That's really beautiful. The next question, I know I'm not going to get through all of these, but there are a few things, few that just jump out at me, like this one, what makes you happy? And again, I wonder how often people think about this and really have a true answer about really know that this thing makes them happy. They know things that make them unhappy.
Yes. And really these questions are also an exercise in discovery, in self-discovery. I don't expect you to know the answer to these questions until you think deeply about them. And what do we discover when we ask ourselves in a deep way, what makes me happy? And it's not ice cream and it's not winning the lottery. What we find is the thing that makes most people happy or brings them real joy, number one, it's generally the fruit of a very slow growing tree. It's not the quick score, the quick win, the quick sale, the momentary pleasure. No. It is the joy that comes from nurturing a relationship over years or decades. You know, for example, you have sons, daughters, both. What do you have?
Two sons.
Okay, you have two sons. Imagine yourself at a friend of yours' son's wedding. How do you feel? You're happy for your friend. And I wish they'd served dinner already. I'm getting tired. My feet hurt. You know, it's cold. You want to go home. You're happy, but you're. Now, imagine yourself at your own son's wedding. And you are in a transcendent realm of inexplicable joy, right? Why? Because of the years and decades of nurturing and raising that child, because of all the sacrifices made, and because it's a communal celebration. Real joy is shared. You can be happy alone. You don't achieve real joy alone in a room. It comes from sacrifice and sharing. Now, if answering this question reveals that to us, then we can have more of that in our lives. We can double down on those relationships and efforts that really, really bring us joy. And that's the point of how the book can both ennoble our lives and the lives of our loved ones when we're gone. And that's why the question is in there. What really makes you happy? Do you really want what you say you want? Really?
Right. For me, as you've been talking, the word slow burn come to mind. You know, those things that you have nurtured over a lifetime, that yes, that you have loved over a lifetime. It is kind of a slow burn and a slow build.
Yes. And you know, that question, what is love, which is in the book, mm-hmm, which most people think, oh, you can't articulate love with words. Well, yes, you can. And here's what we learned. Here's the common denominator in that question. We tend to think of sacrifice in our culture as a net loss, right? She made so many sacrifices. He paid the ultimate sacrifice, right? We tend to think of sacrifice as a net loss. When in fact, when we think about love, well, let's ask you another question, okay? What are the two things that mean the most to you, that you love the most, that mean the most to you in your life? Family, right? Let's include both of the boys and your husband, right?
So yeah.
Family, right? What's second?
Health.
Okay. Now, what are the two things you have sacrificed the most for in your life?
Well, certainly for the children.
Family, right?
Yeah, family.
And you probably sacrifice a lot to take care of yourself too.
Yeah. Yeah, so easy work.
Right. So what do we find? The things that matter most to us, the things we feel the closest to, that we really love and care about, are the people and things we've sacrificed the most for. So this is a counterintuitive point that, again, helps us live more meaningful lives. People think we sacrifice because we love someone. And I make the opposite point in this book, which is we love someone because of sacrifice.
Yep.
You know, in the Bible, the Hebrew word for sacrifice comes from the same word as relatives, as the verb to draw near or draw to be close, to gather in. They all come from the same root word. You know, our ancestors made sacrifices in order to draw closer and nearer to God and to each other, because these sacrificial things were pilgrimages with your family.
Yeah.
And so real love comes from real sacrifice and real community and togetherness.
Mm.
You know, at that same wedding for your son, you're going to look into your husband's eyes and you're going to know in such a deep way that you have reached the pinnacle of human meaning together.
What a great reframe of the word sacrifice.
Yes.
I think many of us don't look at it. We look at sacrifice as something negative, but right, there is so much beauty in sacrifice.
It's a net gain. No one grows poorer by giving. It's a net gain.
I wanted to ask you, because we just have a few minutes left, about... Sure. It's funny, one day I was scrolling through on social media and an ad popped up, and it was for some app or something where you could, you know, record someone's life story on this. And I thought, oh, what a good idea. My mom is 82 now. This is something I should do. And then it was fleeting and I never saw it again. And this is along those same lines, but I'm wondering, people who have gone through your book and all of the questions and done this, what do you think is the most poignant way to do it? I suppose it depends on the person, whether they like the written word or, you know, a video chat. I love the idea of a video.
I think you can do both, but I trust the permanence of words more than video.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I have a bunch of videos that are now DVDs. I don't even have a DVD player anymore. Right. But I still read.
Yes. Right?
And there's something about the power of the written word that is different than the spoken word. And also it's something that you can read a little bit of, you can go back, you know, and I think the likelihood of your loved ones watching your video is it diminishes over time. On the other hand, reading your ethical will, I think, is something that they can go back to again and again and again. as they travel back to you in their minds and in their hearts. So I've written mine out. I typed, you know, it's a computer. I wrote it out on my computer, printed it. I also published it in this book. And my kids have read it. Again, don't wait. Don't wait. Why wait to say these things to the people you love? Don't wait. Tell them now.
Yeah.
Tell them now.
Tell them now, but also tell yourself now. These are important questions.
Exactly. Is my life kabuki? And if it is, what am I going to do about that?
Exactly. I'm speaking with Rabbi Steve Leader. His book is For You When I Am Gone. I wanted to just comment on, there's a second question that is similar to the first question, what do you regret? And it's, what was your biggest failure? And I'm wondering why you separated those questions.
I separated them because most people ultimately don't regret their biggest failure, because their greatest success is rooted in that failure.
Yeah.
Ask people why they married their spouse and they'll tell you, well, because I was in a miserable relationship before that. And when I met him or I met her, I realized, oh, this is how it should be, right? Ask people about their greatest achievement professionally. And I promise you that achievement will be rooted in a previous failure, right? Right. So we don't learn very much from success. It doesn't teach us very much. We really learn from failure, which ultimately means we grow not to regret the failure. We grow to embrace and appreciate it. And that's why they're two separate questions and two separate lessons in a way for our loved ones.
Yes. For You When I Am Gone is the name of the book. My guest, Rabbi Steve Leader. I'm so happy that you could join me again, Steve. I just wanted to let you know that your last book, The Beauty of What Remains, was instrumental in coping with some grief that I had, the loss of a very close friend within days of the time I interviewed you on that book. And I included many of your words in a eulogy to him. So thank you.
That means a lot. That's worth writing the book to know that, you know, and I hope this book is every bit as meaningful to everyone who takes the time to read it. And I greatly appreciate you. I always love talking to you.
Thanks so much, Rabbi Steve.
And again, that was a previously aired interview. Love talking with Rabbi Steve Leader, and look forward to our conversation next week with Dr. Michael Roizen on longevity. Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Stay tuned now for National Public Radio news from Washington. And also, catch our archive shows at kpcw.org under the Shows tab and The Mountain Life.